the world is facing a direct threat from the use of a nuclear weapon, provided that the situation continues to develop as it is developing at the moment. The U.S. president also said that he knows the Russian leader fairly well, and that is why he thinks that Vladimir Putin is not joking when he talks about potential use of tactical nuclear weapons. On 21st of September, Russian President Vladimir Putin said in his televised address that Washington is pushing Kiev towards moving military actions to Russian territory, with nuclear blackmail coming into play. He noted that the issue is not only about the shelling of Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which risks a nuclear catastrophe, but also about statements made by certain high-ranking representatives of leading NATO countries on the possibility and acceptability of using weapons of mass destruction, in particular nuclear weapons, against Russia. The British newspaper The Times has more on the story. US President Joe Biden warned that the conflict in Ukraine could lead to Armageddon during a Democratic fundraiser recently, adding that nuclear tensions were at the highest level since the peak of the Cold War brinkmanship in the 1960s. Joe Biden's comments triggered some alarm among Americans, but were quickly followed by clarifications from the White House and the Pentagon. According to the clarifications, in fact, there was no intelligence or indication that President Putin has either made the decision to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine or has done anything to get closer to that decision-making process. In the meantime, Poland, a major supplier of weapons to Kiev in its battle against Russian forces, has suggested that Washington expand its nuclear sharing program and deploy warheads on its territory to serve as a deterrent against Moscow. Polish President Andrzej Duda and Deputy Prime Minister Jarosław Kaczyński have both floated the proposal in recent months. Russian officials have repeatedly stated that a nuclear war should never be fought, while Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu in August made it clear that Moscow is not considering a nuclear strike on Ukraine, given that there are no targets warranting such a drastic measure. Russian ambassador to the United States Anatoly Antonov said recently the United States is seeking to dismember Russia into several separate principalities and deprive it of nuclear weapons and its status as a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. He said in a video address to the participants at the international conference marking the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Anatoly Antonov said, "Whereas the consequences of the Cuban Missile Crisis was the recognition of the possibility of peaceful coexistence of two great powers, now, over the past decade, Washington has set out to subvert Russia, bringing it to its knees, or even better, to dismember it into several separate principalities, and naturally, to deprive it of nuclear weapons and a legal place as a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council." He pointed to the United States' tough pressure along all of Russia's borders, where Ukraine is used as a testing ground for this most hostile scenario.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The New York Times recently sacked a Palestinian photographer from Gaza because of his support for the resistance to the occupation. In this week's programme, we'll be looking at the forces behind that decision and the way in which the Zionist regime marshals its forces internationally to remove critics of the occupation from their jobs. I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra.
A Palestinian who spent 4 years working for the New York Times in Gaza has been dismissed by the newspaper following the intervention of an Israel lobby group. Hossam Salim said that he was informed via an abrupt phone call from the US outlet that they will no longer be working with him in the future. He even stated that the lobby group not only succeeded in terminating his contract with the New York Times, it has also actively discouraged other international news agencies from collaborating with me and my two colleagues. Of course, the New York Times had no problem employing Ethan Broner, Isabel Kirshner, and David Brooks to write about Palestine, while all three had children fighting in the Israeli military. But who was this lobby group behind this dismissal, and how close is it to the Israeli regime? The ironically named Honest Reporting was founded in 2006 by Joe Hyams, who is a registered bureau speaker for the Israeli embassy in the US. Another founder is Simon Ploska, who worked in the spokesman unit of the Israeli military, also for Israel lobby group BICOM. The CEO of Honest Reporting, until very recently, was Daniel Pomerantz, who before that was a civilian volunteer in the Israeli military. The current CEO, Jackie Alexander, worked for Israel lobby giant AIPAC for 15 years. The role of senior international connector in Honest Reporting is served by David Mensah, who led the Labour Friends of Israel in Britain for over a decade. He counts speech writing for Prime Ministers Boris Johnson, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown on his resume. Rakela Karamson works as digital media specialist at Honest Reporting. She previously was in the central command of the Israeli military during the Second Intifada. The lead designer at the pressure group is Bentzi Binder, who was in the Israeli military Givati Combat Infantry Brigade. The current senior editor of Honest Reporting, Gideon Ben-Tzvi, was also part of the Israeli military. The executive director of Honest Reporting, Gil Hoffman, says that he does not hide the fact that he served in the spokesperson's unit of the Israeli military. Palestine Declassified has obtained footage of him talking openly about his organization's relationship with the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Today I went to a meeting at the Foreign Ministry where there were organizations that work in the pro-Israel sphere that they hosted that are their non-governmental organizations. And there were 60 of us there in the room. And the government was explaining what it's doing and how they want to work better with us. It was quite impressive. We've got WhatsApp groups now that are run by the government where we share information, working together.
So it's clear that Hossam Salim, a Palestinian photographer from Gaza, was fired from his job at the New York Times by the Israeli military.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Andri Nieuwhof. Andri is a writer and human rights advocate based in the Netherlands. She's a former anti-apartheid activist at the Holland Committee on South Africa, and she writes an occasional blog for the Electronic Intifada. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. I mean, yet another example of someone being sacked over a social media statement critical of the Zionist entity. This is becoming an all too regular occurrence, isn't it?
Well, there's a pattern of behaviour, to coin a phrase there. They are doing this all over the world. Wherever there are people who are standing up for Palestinian rights, they are gone for and they target them. And this is, you know, as we can see from the film there, this is something which is coordinated by the Zionist regime itself. These are not autonomous Israel lobby groups. They're all instruments and assets of the Zionist regime, so we shouldn't be surprised. This is a worldwide phenomenon. We should see it as a connected thing because it is.
Yeah. I mean, Andri, the lobby employee who wrote this hit piece used to work for the Dutch Zionist lobby group, the Center for Information and Documentation Israel. I mean, you've written about the CIDI. What impact does it have on democracy in the Netherlands? I mean, does it undermine it in any way, do you think?
Well, they try to stifle people who are critical of Israel's violations of international law against Palestinians. The impact in the public sphere is not as large as it is for example, in the UK or in the US. But they are present. And as you can see, this guy von Koningsfeld, he learned a bit the job while he was at TV. He was invited by Gilad Erdan of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs on several missions. So that's how he learned the job.
Yes. I mean, David, this connection between honest reporting and the Israeli military seems pretty extensive. I mean, how widespread is it in Zionist lobby groups?
Well, we've reported on this a number of times, you'll remember. I mean, it's a very, very widespread pattern in lobby groups, but also in startups and companies started by people who've come out of the military, sometimes out of the intelligence services of the Zionist regime. So it's just a very widespread pattern. And we see people who present as being policy analysts or PR advisors, but of course, you know, almost all of them will have had some kind of experience in what's called the IDF, the occupation forces of the Zionist regime. So it's essentially a network which is being formed with people with common experiences.
Yeah. I mean, Andre, can you tell us more about the activities of this guy, von Koningsfeld?
Yeah. When he was in the Netherlands, he was very active for CD, but he was so much younger. Now he's more sophisticated in a way, more brutal. But during the CD times, he tried to bully people. He wrote letters to universities to cancel a debate on academic boycott. He, on Twitter, incited people to become active against people who spoke in favor of Palestinian rights. He was, as a young person, at 17, he said, I want to become the mayor of Utrecht, so he has quite, I say, an ego. And he converted to Judaism, and then he went to Israel, and he lives now there in an illegal settlement of, I say, Ili. I don't know if I pronounce it correctly. It's quite orthodox. And I would say, in the Netherlands, during his activism, he used the information of NG Monitor. And in a way, now he produces his own information at Honest Reporting, using the same tactic, guilty by association, checking people's social media, trying to find some what he considers evidence to smear people. And business as usual, like David says, it's a tactic of people who support Israel at any cost.
Yes. I mean, David, what do you make of the New York Times employing three writers to cover Palestine who simultaneously have children in the Israeli military?
I mean, again, this is something we've seen a number of times in different programs, that it's not just that they've had experience of the occupation army and presumably of human rights abuses, but they are actually doing it at the same time as a job for which there's a clear conflict of interest. Mm. And I don't think that the mainstream media organizations have got any conception of what they're doing here. This is a party to a conflict. And people can't be journalists and parties to a conflict at the same time. It's a fundamental contradiction.
No, indeed. Certainly wouldn't have thought so. It's a very strange state of affairs. I mean, Andre, I mean, we also understand that a member of the CIDI's staff actually stood for the Dutch parliament on the ticket of the far-right party for freedom, led by Geert Wilders. I mean, are there any other connections between the Israel lobby and the far-right in the Netherlands?
Yes. In fact, a few years ago, two, 3 years ago, two staff members of CD were a member of the Thierry Baudet's Forum for Democracy, which now for everybody is clear, it's an extremist right-wing party. And at the time we warned CD, you have those people in your staff. But, you know, you are saying you are against Semitism, but look who you're working with. this party hates Muslims, and you're on the wrong track. So the links, but with the exposure of Thierry Baudet and his party, they try to cover up in a way and distance themselves from it. But the links with the PVV are still there. And there's a new party, a farmers party. And they're also right-wing. And now you see they shift to this party, to using it as a tool to pose their questions, to influence parliament with motions. So the links, I say, are quite strong. And you never hear Zionist lobby groups about the settlement, and you know, when they really follow the agenda of the Israeli propaganda, like when we had the sad event that a Palestinian homosexual was murdered, kidnapped from Israel. Everybody, every pro-Israel activist says, oh, you see the Palestinians, but in fact, they don't give a damn about the rights of Palestinians. They're in fact anti-Palestinian, anti-Muslim. That's the agenda. And at times, it's quite sickening. Going back to the influence of Koningsfeld, the national broadcaster NOS appointed a correspondent for the Middle East, and her name is Nasra Abibala. So you can imagine what happened before. Same treatment like the photographer, but the NOS stood their ground, and there was a whole campaign on Twitter
Them. Let's just pause there for a moment, Adi, if we may, because I just want to listen to this report on the role of the Zionist regime in running pro-Israel networks around the world.
We've got WhatsApp groups now that are run by the government, where we share information, working together.
These were the words of Gil Hoffman of Honest Reporting, revealing the close coordination between the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and nationally independent pro-Israel groups all over the world. But the strategic use of pro-Israel groups by the Zionist regime is not new. The Ministry of Strategic Affairs, or MSA, which had the lead role in the global war on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, created a network back in 2018. Here is the Jerusalem Post describing the network at an awards ceremony in 2019.
The Digital Network is a group of bloggers and social media experts established by Minister Ardan's Ministry of Strategic Affairs in March 2018. There are already 100 members from 20 countries around the world who together have a reach of about 15 million people in more than five languages. The network works 24/7 to defend Israel on the internet, to combat BDS, and attempts to boycott the world's only Jewish state.
At the awards ceremony, one can see Dutch lobby veteran Hidde van Koningsveld holding the Digital 19 placard. He was the author of the dossier which resulted in the sacking of the Gaza-based photographer Hossam Salim from the New York Times. He converted to Judaism and changed his name to Akiva to Judaize it, and now lives on an illegal settlement in occupied Palestine. The network has members in India, South Africa, Brazil, and many other places. All the key lobby groups are involved, including CAMRA, Stand With Us, NGO Monitor, and Honest Reporting, for which van Koningsveld works. UK members include operatives from the Nasher Jew troll account on Twitter, such as David Collier, as well as Simon Cobbs from Sussex Friends of Israel. One of the key tactics of the Zionist playbook is to lean in to accurate charges, as if to say, how ridiculous. They calculate that this is more effective than denying the truth. So the MSA producing publicity at their Digitel conference, proclaiming that their undercover Hasbro trolls. They even produced a birthday cake with a blue-haired troll on it. Zionist asset Simon Cobbs of Sussex Friends of Israel leaned into that, appealing for money to be sent to his groups without revealing, of course, that they were already in receipt of ministry largesse. Meanwhile, one of the UK's best-known non-Jewish Zionists, the former arms lobbyist Luke Akers, follows the same script. Here he is on the left with close Zionist collaborators posing in their distastefully unique t-shirts. It's no surprise that Akers is also a member of the network, having attended the first conference in 2018 on behalf of We Believe in Israel. When they tell you it's anti-Semitic to say they all work together, remember, that is a lie.
David, I mean, has Gil Hoffman let the cat out of the bag on the coordination via WhatsApp groups of apparently autonomous Zionist organisations, do you think?
Well, he has, hasn't he? I mean, this is a private Zoom meeting, but it was obviously cast on the internet. And he said, yes, these are WhatsApp groups we have. They're run by the government. We coordinate. We work together. And, of course, this is what this digital network is for. And they say it very clearly in the film there. This is a network. We all work together. And they use the same lines. And so, of course, they're going to be targeting Gazan photographers for the New York Times or MPs for the Labour Party in England or journalists in places and academics and others. So, of course, they're doing this in a way which is calculated and coordinated. And, of course, when you see the troll accounts in this country, for example, Nasher Jew and many others, this is a coordinated effort to target anyone who will stand up for the Palestinians. It's not something which they do because they're scared Jews in the UK or in the US. It's because they're there to work with, directly with, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs as it is now and the Ministry of Strategic Affairs as it was then in the Zionist entity itself. This is an overseas foreign policy strategy by the State of Israel. It's not any kind of an autonomous argument against anti-Semitism.
No, indeed. Audrey, what about this guy Hidi? I mean, he was a guest of the Zionist regime in 2018 and 2019, I believe. And do you think people are aware of the network nature of the Zionist lobby?
The uneducated public, not, but the activists, they are very much aware. There was a report published 2 years ago about the effort to limit the public space for speak about Palestinian rights. And it was very clear how the modus operandi was. NGO Monitor comes with information, it's taking up by CD, questions in parliament, pushing the minister to defund organizations like Al-Haq. I think it's very clear. Maybe not really the size of the network, but if you are really on a day-to-day basis busy with defending Palestinian rights, you know, I think it would be interesting if Dutch needs and would pay more attention to the international. Because that's what CD tries to hide. Eh? It's like Center for Information Documentation Israel. Sounds very neutral, but the agenda is really different. And what I find frightening is that the board member is now appointed as the national coordinator to combat Semitism. He was in charge when all the stifling academics happened, and Hidde van Koningsfeld was the one who really pushed for it. Yes. So it doesn't sound good.
Yes. I mean, David, the digital conferences were about creating an international network that could be used to coordinate activities and messages. I mean, do you think it's working?
It's working at one level. I mean, this is what we've seen for the last, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years now, an attempt to coordinate attacks on supporters of Palestine and critics of the State of Israel. And they go after people. They dig up past things they might have said on social media. They distort the meaning of those things, and then they go to their employers and they try to get their performances cancelled, or their jobs removed, or their candidacy stopped. And there are literally hundreds of these things happening. I mean, all across the world where they have people active, and you saw them bragging there about them being active in countries all over the world, in different languages, different huge numbers of organizations. And that's what they're all doing. They're all trying to make sure that they can target anyone who will stand up for Palestinian rights. So it's working at that level because many people, as you and I both know,
indeed,
have lost their positions.
Absolutely.
And that's happened in other countries too. But at another level, of course, they are panicking because they can see the writing on the wall. Even Israeli ministers have said this, that they might not be able to withstand the Palestinian resistance. Yeah. And that, you know, as we speak, the Palestinian resistance is girding its loins for a major confrontation.
Indeed.
And this is something which we have been living with since last May, since a year ago last May. When the resistance in occupied Palestine beat the IDF and beat them back.
We're
facing the possibility, I've said this before, of a collapse of the Zionist entity.
Yes.
And it might happen much sooner than we think.
Yeah. I mean, Adrie, we've also looked into other key Israel lobby groups in the Netherlands, like Christians for Israel International and the Israel Product Center. I mean, what do you know about their operations?
Well, they are, of course, firmly rooted in the churches. And they are Zionist. They are linked. And the Christian product center was fined this year for their labeling the product from settlement as made in Israel. So there is a pushback in the Netherlands. But these groups, there's quite a lot of money. Some of their workers are living in Israel, or a past worker in Israel in a settlement, the same settlement as von Koningsfeld lived in. It's really tough to deal with them because their agenda is clear. The settlements for them, it's the same as Israel. They are firm believers. But their influence is limited to their own church. So that's on the positive side. And there you come with Forsidi. They are a token of hope, Forsidi, and that's the opportunism of the pro-Israel lobby. They grab whomever wants to support Israel, whether it's Orban or in the Netherlands, the Christian Zionists.
I mean, David, there were a number of UK participants in this network. I mean, does that mean they're likely to be working together and to be directed by the Zionist regime? Very briefly, we've only got about a minute left.
Well, yes, I mean they are working together. We know this. I mean, we know that Luke Akehurst, who is is in the Labour Party, he's on the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party, poses as being some kind of leftist. We know that these people are working together with the ones who are more obviously rightist, the trolls like the National Jew, for example. They do coordinate, Sussex Friends of Israel, they coordinate as well. There's a clear coordination. They get money, some of these organisations, when the Ministry of Strategic Affairs was in operation, they got money directly from the ministry through various pass-throughs. So yes, we know there's a coordination. But of course, as soon as we say there's a coordination, they shout anti-Semitism as if it would be impossible for them to work together.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there as we're right out of time. Thanks to Adrie Newhoff and to obviously our resident expert, Professor David Miller. We will, of course, be back next week at the same time. So please tune in then. As I say, we'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Will Wilkerson, the co-founder of Donald Trump's beleaguered social media company, has turned whistleblower, alleging the firm violated federal securities laws. He also says Donald Trump pressured executives to hand over lucrative shares to his wife, Melania. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CNBC has more details. Former President Donald Trump's media company fired an executive on Thursday, 13th of October, after he shared internal documents from a Securities and Exchange Commission SEC whistleblower complaint with the Washington Post and spoke with the newspaper. The news outlet reported on Saturday. Will Wilkerson was a senior vice president of operations at Trump Media and Technology, which owns the social network Truth Social, and was one of the company's first employees. Wilkerson filed the SEC whistleblower complaint in August, alleging that the company relied on fraudulent misrepresentations in violation of federal securities laws, according to the Washington Post, in its bid to be taken public via an investment vehicle known as Special Purpose Acquisition Company, or SPAC. In the article, Will Wilkerson also described strife within Trump Media, including tension with Chief Executive Officer Devin Nunes. Devin Nunes was a Republican congressman, and he was one of Donald Trump's most loyal defenders in Congress. Wilkerson also said another executive detailed how Donald Trump pressured him to give shares in the company to his wife, Melania Trump. A spokeswoman for Trump Media pushed back on the Washington Post story and touted Truth Media's availability on the Apple App Store, the Google Play Store, and Samsung's Galaxy Store. As chairman of TMTG, President Trump hired Devin Nunes as chief executive officer to create a culture of compliance and build a world-class team to lead Truth Social, the spokeswoman said in a statement. Digital World Acquisition Corp., or DWAC, the Special Purpose Acquisition Company, seeking to take the media company public, didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. Trump Media fired Will Wilkerson for making unauthorized disclosures to the Washington Post. One of his lawyers called the firing a retaliation against the whistleblower, according to the report. There are laws that protect whistleblowers. The report comes as Digital World Acquisition Corp. pushes its shareholders to vote to delay its planned merger with Trump Media, which was announced last year. Digital World Acquisition Corp. has warned it could liquidate if it doesn't complete the merger, which would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Trump Media. Digital World Acquisition Corp. Chief Executive Officer Patrick Orlando directed another one of his companies to give DWAC funding to keep it afloat until December. He has already adjourned a shareholder meeting four times, an indication that he doesn't have the shareholder support to delay the merger. The Trump Media DWAC deal is being investigated by regulators at the Securities and Exchange Commission and prosecutors in the Justice Department. Trump Media has blamed the Securities and Exchange Commission for delaying the deal. In the article, Will Wilkerson also described undisclosed discussions between Trump, his media company's executives, and Orlando last year before Digital World Acquisition Corp. went public and a deal was announced. Those talks may have violated Securities and Exchange Commission rules. Wilkerson shared internal logs, memos, photographs, videos, and other material relevant to the Securities and Exchange Commission investigation with the Washington Post. All of the materials were previously provided to government investigators, the Washington Post said, citing Wilkerson's attorneys. British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. The co-founder of Donald Trump's beleaguered social media company has turned whistleblower, alleging the firm violated federal securities laws and that the former president pressured executives to hand over lucrative shares to his wife Melania. Will Wilkerson, a former Trump Media and Technology Group executive, has told the U.S. government's financial watchdog that the company's bid to raise more than $1 billion via an investment vehicle known as a Special Purpose Acquisition Company, or SPAC, relied on fraudulent misrepresentations in violation of federal securities laws. Trump Media and Technology Group is the company that launched Trump's Truth Social platform after Twitter and Facebook banned the former president for his role in the deadly 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol. Will Wilkerson, who was sacked from his role as senior vice president for operations last week after speaking to the Washington Post, filed a whistleblower complaint to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission in August. He backed his complaint with a cache of emails, documents, messages, and audio recordings, which detail a pattern of rancorous infighting, technical incompetence, and power struggles inside Trump Media since its launch last year. Among the emails in an exchange between Wilkerson and fellow co-founder Andy Litinsky, who was allegedly fired as payback for refusing to hand over some of his shares worth millions of dollars to former First Lady Melania Trump, according to the Washington Post. Donald Trump has already been given 90% of the company's shares in exchange for the use of his name and some minor involvement. In the email provided to the Securities and Exchange Commission, Andy Litinsky, who first met Donald Trump in 2004 as a contestant on the TV show The Apprentice, said that Trump was retaliating against me by threatening to blow up the company if his demands are not met. The Securities and Exchange Commission was already investigating the merger between Trump Media and the DWAC, Digital World Acquisition Corporation, which has been on hold since last October due to civil and criminal investigations, as well as a lackluster investor backing. Wilkerson's lawyers have said that he is cooperating with investigators at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and New York-based federal prosecutors are also looking into alleged criminality at Trump Media in relation to the merger, which would have led to a $1.3 billion cash injection. Digital World's share price dived to under $18 on Friday from a high of $175. Investors were promised more than 50 million users by 2024, but so far, Donald Trump, the main attraction on the platform, has less than 5 million followers, just a fraction of the 88 million he had on Twitter. The whistleblower complaint was first reported by the Miami Herald, but Trump Media fired Will Wilkerson last Thursday, citing his unauthorized disclosures to the Washington Post. His lawyer, Phil Brewster, described the move as patent retaliation against a Securities and Exchange Commission whistleblower of the worst kind.
Insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing European security polarization and the new Cold War against Russia with Professor Heinz Gettner from the University of Vienna. But first, this brief analysis.
Decades of aggressive eastward expansion by US-led NATO towards the borders of the Russian Federation following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the aftershocks of the Russian invasion of Ukraine have led to a dramatic security polarization in Europe, not seen since the height of the Cold War in the mid-20th century. The dreams of a borderless Europe from the Ural Mountains to the Atlantic Ocean seem very naive these days, as a hard border is being established between the Russian Federation and neighboring European countries, with a dramatic increase in the level of militarization on both sides, which, if history is to be guide, will not be dismantled very quickly once it's firmly established. Even the previously non-aligned countries of Sweden and Finland have joined NATO. It seems the old British plan of preventing a strategic alignment between Russia and Europe, and particularly between Russia and Germany, is once again being implemented. However, this time this effort is being led by Britain's American cousins, who inherited the British Empire following World War II. It's precisely in the period of the so-called American unipolar moment in the late 1990s and early 21st century, where the world witnessed the aggressive expansion of NATO towards the western borders of Russia. The instrumentalization of Ukraine, the weaponization of Ukrainian nationalism against Russia and Russian speakers in Ukraine, and the threat of Ukrainian NATO membership was the final straw and repeatedly stated red line that pushed Russia to take preemptive military action against NATO expansion into Ukraine. The severe reactions and sanctions by the Western countries against Russia have led Russia to strategically reorient itself towards the east and southeast, towards China and Iran. This has been very beneficial for Eurasian integration and particularly for boosting Iran-Russia relations, and it represents a very significant historic and geostrategic shift. But the question remains whether it's in the national interests of European countries to have bad political and economic relations with Russia. Is it really in the interests of many European nations to sanction and vilify their most important energy and raw material supplier and one of their largest export markets? Despite historically high inflation, the threat of closure of major industries, and exponential rises in energy costs, brainwashed Atlanticist European elites continue to repeat the anti-Russian propaganda designed in US and NATO think tanks, contrary to what many of the citizens believe, which is neutrality and non-alignment based on the real, tangible interests of nations. Of course, the people of Europe have so far received their reply from their elites. As for example, when the young, inexperienced German foreign minister proudly announced that helping Ukraine is more important than what German voters want. It remains to be seen how she and her party will fare the next time German voters get to vote on what they want. Cracks are already appearing in the European facade as nations such as Hungary and Serbia are trying to take an independent position based on their national interests vis-a-vis Russia, as well as countries such as Austria, who are warning about the consequences of unilateral energy sanctions and trying to moderate the anti-Russian rhetoric. But in general, it seems that nearly all European elites have once again shown their geopolitical impotence and inability to form policies independent from US and NATO diktats. As we head into this year's cold winter in Europe, we will have to see how much the European people are willing to sacrifice from their high standards of living in the pursuit of this new Cold War against Russia, which has divided Europe and forced a major historic and geopolitical realignment in the world, and which, contrary to US and NATO propaganda, does not appear to be in Europe's long-term interests.
Professor Heinz Gettner, Professor of Political Science, University of Vienna, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
You're welcome.
When we heard that you're coming to Tehran, we asked you to come join us in person for this interview. You kindly replied to this request, so here we are. We want to talk, as you know, the program Insight is really a program where we try to look at things strategically. We try to get a deeper understanding of what's going on. And one of the major issues of the world today is what the events that are happening in Europe, particularly the events that have now occurred with the war in Ukraine. And it seems that there is a new security architecture, a new security structure, a new reality that has descended upon Europe, a reality which in many ways is very similar to the Cold War. You have this hard border again being drawn between Europe and Russia. You have countries that even during the Cold War, like Finland and Sweden, who weren't part of NATO, are joining NATO. But here we have to then look at really again this bad faith that we see from the West and from the Americans, which is, so you have this Ukraine after the Soviet Union, which has a significant Russian-speaking population, culturally Russian population. And then they do the Maidan coup. They bring in these neo-Nazi groupings that are part of this coalition. We don't want to say that they were the main people, but they were a significant part. And you change the constitution. They get rid of the Russian language as part of the constitutional rights of the Russian people. You have the civil war starting in 2014. So, yes, I mean, your point is well taken that that this would have been a good situation. But it seems to me that the last thing that the Americans or NATO wanted is a Ukraine where people are living together in peace. They actually were provoking the Russians in many ways with the attacks that they did particularly on the Russian population. And then when the NATO membership was mentioned, again, we are trying to analyze. We're not trying to justify or to agree or disagree with whatever decision was made in Russia. But it is understandable from an analytical perspective, if the Russians felt like there was no other option left for them, because they tried all the political options, and it seemed, whether it was the Minsk agreements, whatever, all the other political and diplomatic formulas and ways to deal with this, they saw it was not happening. And maybe this is something going back to the essence of Ukraine. You have this country being created, as you mentioned, and Henry Kissinger mentioned a long time ago, that you have actually two
March
Ukraines.
2014.
Exactly. that you have actually two Ukraines. It's not one country. You have this Ukraine in the West, which is Catholic and much more culturally closer to Poland and that part of Europe. And then you have the East, which is culturally closer to Russia. So what I want to say, because you mentioned these very interesting things. So what you're saying is that essentially we've had this historic turn, this historic event happening, where Russia is separated from Europe, where it separated itself, if we want to analyze it from that perspective, or the Europeans decided with the Americans to separate themselves from the Russians. In Iran, of course, we would say that this was good for us, because then Russia came towards the Asian side, came closer to China, became closer to Iran. As we see, there's very extensive an increase of relations between Iran and Russia in this time. So maybe geopolitically for Asia or Eurasia, this was better. But again, my question is it really in the national interests of a lot of these European countries to have this cordon sanitaire, this hard border? If you look at Hungary, it's trying to have some sort of an independent policy with Russia. It's not, in terms of, at least rhetorically and in terms of the way they speak, they're being a little bit more cautious in terms of their relation with Russia. You see even Austria in many ways trying to maintain its neutrality within this idea of what's going on, this alliance building, as you say. We see, of course, Serbia, traditionally a natural ally of the Russians, culturally close to the Russians, basically saying that they will not join NATO no matter what. So again, my question is, as a European, I'm asking you, is it really in many of these countries, particularly those who are closer to Russia, who are maybe dependent in terms of energy and gas and coal and and raw materials? Is it really in their interest to be in a Cold War and a kind of a non-relation state with Russia?
Let me make two points. First point, briefly. I don't think we have that much time anymore.
No, go ahead.
So, to Ukraine. I have to say, Russia was not really fond of neutrality either. So Russia said that I would be in, that would support a non-NATO membership of NATO, which is was credible, I would think. Every Russian president repeated that. But they did not really speak about neutrality. They didn't really. So because that meant the Russian supported militias in the east.
Right. That means Russia would also have to.
Well, Russia would have. It would be an example also for Moldova and Georgia, where you have Russian troops or peacekeepers. So it would be a model for others as well. So the Russians would not really support neutrality. And I have to say, if Ukraine would have become neutral, it could get its territorial sovereignty and territorial integrity back. So it's a unified, you mentioned it's divided. The Russians might have speculated that they want somehow keep the eastern part.
Right.
But if there would be a neutral, would have been a neutral Ukraine, all foreign powers would have to leave, and Ukraine would have the possibility, like Austria, to create its own identity. Right. Sovereignty.
In other words, nobody wanted a neutral Ukraine, neither NATO and neither Russia.
Unfortunately, you're right.
Exactly.
Some supported it, like Henry Kissinger, Mearsheimer as well. They came later as well with the suggestion. So there are some pundits who really thought that it might be the best. But politically, you're correct. You're correct. So your second point, do the Europeans really want to have this divided Europe? So, and I have to say no. So
exactly.
Because now Putin brought war, and Putin and NATO brought the division of Europe back, like in the Cold War, but that was our starting point. Now it plays out like in this polarization. We have a division of Europe, cordon sanitaire. It even goes to the cultural level. So
it's ridiculous. Some of the sanctions are ridiculous. Sports, culture, opera singers,
arts, science. It's ridiculous. To talk to Russian
scientists. We were joking in Iran that it's even worse than the sanctions against Iran, which we thought would never happen.
I don't know whether I could speak on Russian TV like I speak here. So we have this new cordon sanitaire, and it will last decades. And the Europeans cannot want to have this.
Exactly.
So they have to think about it, maybe not immediately, but we do have concepts from the history which it could be applied.
So let's talk about that a little.
So I just mentioned two of them.
Right.
So one is, because I'm coming from Vienna, we had the Vienna Congress of 1815. Okay. We had the Napoleonic Wars, and then the victory powers would sit together, and they would ask France to come to the table a little bit later on as well, and created an order for Europe which was peaceful first half a century, and then we had this wars of unification, another Crimean war. But then it lasted another half century after the first war. So it was based on balance of power, at the same time on liberal concepts, common values. I have to say, there were all colonial powers. So the interventions in the south, that was permitted.
Exactly, that was part of
that was the caveat of this. But for Europe, it was not such a bad concept to sit together and to avoid another war, which was successful, at least half a century, you can say. Then you had this war. So Europeans should think about it. Is this type applicable to have a big conference when the war is over, to think about it? We have to somehow bring in Russia back to Europe.
Right.
Like Europe did it after the Second World War with the Marshall Plan. After the First World War, they isolated Germany.
And didn't work.
The result was Hitler. The Nazis, no?
Exactly. So after World War II, they had the Marshall Plan
And then the second concept I would like to mention is during the height of the Cold War, we had a conference on security and cooperation, the Helsinki Accords of 75. And this was an interesting concept. Height of the Cold War, we had the arms race, of course, we had at the same time the German Ostpolitik and also the the Downpolitik by President Nixon. It was all a global context, exactly. Of course, but exactly. it was the Helsinki Conference. And if you look at the Helsinki documents, they do not mention the words enemy, foe, competitor, rival. Right. If you look at the security strategies right now, yeah, they're all full of the full of this. And why? And it speaks about common security, cooperative security. And why is it interesting theoretically? So we talked about the security dilemma before. The security, if you make a decision, security, the other one would react somehow. That would be, I increase my security, and the other would feel it offensive. And so the idea was not to increase the security, but to lower the threat level.
Exactly.
A common security is the opposite of the security dilemma.
Right.
Common security was also the idea of the Palme Commission later on.
Right.
Willy Brandt, Palme, Kreisky, so they had this, this idea.
Yes.
So this lower the threat and not increase my military capacity.
And they were all social democrats. Olaf Palme, Willy Brandt, Bruno Kreisky.
I have to mention this. The one who really prevented a neutral Central Europe in the 50s, according to the Austrian model, there were ideas, Western pundits, not Stalin. So it was George Kennan as well. Mm-hmm. It was Labour Party leader Hugh Gaitskell. It was the bipartisan initiative, Noland Humphrey from the US. They all said Rapacki Plan, Polish foreign minister. They wanted to create a neutral Central Europe, a nuclear weapon-free,
right,
with the inclusion of Germany. Germany would be unified, but it would be also Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary would not part of the Warsaw Pact. So the one who really was opposed to it was Konrad Adenauer, etc.
Right.
But I have to say the father of Austrian neutrality was also a conservative. It was Julius Raab. So
genau.
There was a conflict between Adenauer and Raab. So I had to mention this because you said there were all social democrats.
Maybe we can do a program on Austria one day.
No. I know the time is
so. No, that would be interesting one. We should do it one day.
But I said, Europe, let me summarize, you have to think about concepts which go beyond this division. Otherwise, we will have this conflict on sanitaire.
But it seems to me the atmosphere, the public atmosphere, it really is not conductive right now. Any politician who would even mention these things right now, they would, you know, they would hang him up, you know.
That's definitely.
This is a problem, isn't it? I mean, we have a situation where you had this massive propaganda campaign, you know, and it's interesting to me because, you know, Europeans in general, on the average, are much more, you know, conscious, aware, educated, have more information about the world than maybe American public has. So maybe one can understand if the Americans want to, you know, apply this propaganda to their own population because their own population is very ignorant about the world. But the Europeans don't seem to be, are not that ignorant. And yet we see this massive propaganda campaign still going on. The idea that somebody would come out and say, look, we need to talk to the Russians at some point. This is not in our favor. It seems to me this is almost an impossible thing to propose right now as a political figure or as a public figure.
Unfortunately, yes, but it might change if Europe will feel the effects of the war and if they will learn about the casualties. So they're not different than Americans. If you see casualties all the time and refugees and it over time, if a war goes on for too long, it might change the attitude. But on a global level, because you talk about the European citizens, now we have this war situation, which is a very special situation. And in a war, you have always this with me or against me. You have this
dichotomy.
So there is no place for a complex, as we did, complex analysis.
So we have to start.
Right. But let's just mention one thing that was an poll by the European Council on Foreign Relations, which was taken before the war already. But the question was, if there is a conflict between US and China, It didn't even ask military conflict. It only said conflict.
Right.
What options would you choose? Go with China, go with the US, or stay neutral? So 60 to 65 of the Europeans would say the rather would be stay neutral. Of course, they would not want to side with China, but they would not want to be drawn into a military conflict on the side of a conflict with.